This is Jason Stewart with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University, conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Harold Hushbeck. Today is February 24, 2009. I am in Lubbock, Texas, in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech. Mr. Hushbeck is joining me by phone from Eugene, Oregon. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. Why don't we begin, if you don't mind, if you could tell me a little biographical information about yourself. First of all, when and where were you born?
I was born in Berkeley, California.
Okay. All right. And when?
October 15th, 1946.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about your parents? What were their names and what did they do for a living?
My mom was Kathleen Scholes Hushbeck, and she was a housewife for most of her life until the kids moved out, and then she did some office work as a office administrator.
Okay.
And my dad was a his name was Harold Evan Hushbeck Sr., and he was a he went to school at Berkeley. That's why I was born there, and got out and was hired as a livestock feed salesman, and that's what he did for the first 15 years of my life.
Okay. All right. So did you grow up in Berkeley?
No, once he was through the school there, he got hired in Modesto, California, at the home office of this livestock feed company.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about growing up, about what you did for fun as a kid, that type of thing?
Well, I spent a lot of time, I was born in Berkeley, and then we moved to Modesto, and in Modesto I went through kindergarten, and so we ended up being socialized in public schools, and we also socialized a little bit at Presbyterian Church,
mm-hmm.
which my folks were associated with from when they were kids.
Okay.
Then my dad got transferred to the Fresno office, which is in California as well,
mm-hmm.
and he basically drove around to various growers of chickens and sold them chicken feed and things like that. But I spent my time mostly around the yard. We did, like I say, socialize in the church, but
right.
there were very few neighbors that there were a few that were close to us, and we would play with them on the yard, on the lawn, and
mm-hmm.
Then we would go swim in the swimming pools, and especially in the Central Valley there, that was a big thing during the summertime because it was so hot.
Sure.
excuse me. I went to a couple of times I was in Cub Scouts, but most of my socialization was at school.
Okay. Where did you go to school?
Well, I went in they were public schools that were close to where we lived.
Okay.
In the school district. So, do you need the individual?
No, that's fine. did you enjoy school growing up, or what were your favorite subjects?
Well, excuse me, I want to get some water. Here.
Sure.
As a grade school kid, I always felt I was short and fat, so. I wasn't what they would, what people would call in a major clique.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tended to be more of an outdoor kid instead of person who was the center of social
okay.
Families or groups. And I, since my dad did move quite a bit in my first, in my primary school years,
mm-hmm.
I tended to have to go through hooking up with the bad kids when I first got to a new school.
Right.
And then gradually my ability in math was a big thing that I liked. I really did enjoy math because it was fairly, you knew you had the answer right if you knew it, you got it, if you worked on it. And
right.
So it was a lot more strong association with that. I didn't do so well in English or composition until after I got out of, after I went through the service.
Okay.
But, yeah, when we moved, as we moved through school, I basically just sort of went along with the crowd.
Right.
And tried to keep from getting hit, mostly.
Sure. All right. All right. when did you graduate from high school?
Oh, in 1964.
Okay. All right. In this time, when you were a kid, as you were growing up, did you pay any attention to U.S. foreign relations and the Cold War and what was happening in the world?
You know, I was very, I wouldn't say that my family was insular, you know, where we were, we tried to avoid looking at those things. We did have a television, so we did get to see things. I was very much affected by the Kennedy assassination, so I was watching some things, and obviously rockets were a very big thing at that time. And watching rocket launches was big, but I don't believe that. And we did move to down to Lancaster, California, when I was in high school, and that was very close to Edwards Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
Most of that I understood was not necessarily associated with Cold War politics as much as it was just exploration of space, a pure science thing. It wasn't really a political thing that we could feel or that I got when I was a kid. I wasn't that aware of that. There was certainly we were Barry Goldwater and that kind of reactionary right was down there in big numbers. There were a lot of people in Southern California who really got into that.
Mm-hmm.
But my parents were more, I would say, either centrist or, though they were, I mean, in today's language, they were a bit left-leaning, more progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so I picked up on that quite a bit. We didn't really jump onto the reactionary right back bandwagon.
Right. Okay.
But we tried to maintain open communication with those people because they were in our church, and it was interesting to watch that dynamic a little bit. Now that I look back on it, I think at the time I was more my folks didn't try to make. They weren't really. We didn't talk politics that much at the table.
Okay.
I think we did talk about how to live with other people in such a way that you didn't create a lot of tension.
Right.
But we didn't necessarily say, "Yeah, this is the way to go," or "That's the way to go." I mean,
right.
My father had spent a very intense experience in World War II as a pilot. He never got shot down, but he was definitely, his aircraft took a bit of fire, enemy fire.
Mm-hmm.
And so he felt, I mean, he had a very strong sense of patriotism and was very glad to have come out relatively unscathed, in the sense that he didn't ever get hit himself personally. I mean, he didn't have any disabilities from that.
Right. Okay. All right. Did your father ever talk to you about his World War II experience?
He certainly did. I mean, he talked about those close calls a lot, and his interactions with his he was the commander of a Martin seaplane.
Okay.
And so he had a lot of, he was very young, he had a lot of people who were older than he that were his, under his command, and he really felt, he died last year, so he talked a lot about it, and as he was, as we knew he was dying, he had cancer, and so I went down to take care of him, and he talked a lot about it because I think that was his most, he felt most successful about what he had done there.
Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
He talked about his various times where there were close calls.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Did your father's experiences and what he told you, did it in any way influence or color your view of the military?
Well, yes, I think so. I'm sure he, for instance, he really encouraged me to try to get into the military academies, which I did as I was a junior and senior in high school. I was working on that.
Okay.
And I did not qualify, or at the time, a lot of that was a political. A lot of those appointments were political appointments.
Right.
And my dad didn't have the connections.
Mm-hmm.
Nor was I particularly a good candidate because I didn't have a lot of extracurricular activities in school, and I wasn't, I didn't play a sport.
Mm-hmm.
I tended to be more of a geek and was not very physically developed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and I wasn't aggressive, which was, at the time, I think it's kind of essential
mm-hmm.
for doing any of those things. So I think, but other than that, he did spend a lot of time, I mean, he did talk about the military service in a positive way.
Right, okay.
He didn't really just give it a bad rap at all.
Mm-hmm.
He thought there were it was certainly valuable in the Second World War.
Right.
And I'm not sure how at the time he didn't feel particularly strong in his sort of anti-communist or anti things that weren't totally American.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly had his. He didn't project that I should be following a particular way of thinking about things.
Right.
He really wanted me to be open to hearing all sides of the thing. But both he and his brother had been in the Navy, and he had a sister in the Marines, one of the early women Marines, and they had all had very successful military experiences. So they all kind of gave me pats on the back and said, "Sure, go ahead, get enlisted, do something. If you don't have," and I didn't have the grades to get a free ride in college. So the military was one of the better ways to get out of the house and not burden my dad with the cost of supporting me.
Right.
And okay. That's kind of why I went in.
All right. You mentioned a moment ago, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about some of the things you mentioned a moment ago. You talked about the Kennedy assassination and the effect it had on you. Could you tell me a little bit more about that? What do you remember about that day?
Well, just, it was much like September 11th,
mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that something... And also the Martin Luther King assassination. It's
mm-hmm.
like I was in our family was very I think relatively insular from those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in the suburbs, and so we didn't associate with violence very much, and we were kind of So it had a very large impact in the sense that to realize that that was possible, that people
right.
did that, and that there were folks who had didn't have the sort of the social break on that kind of behavior,
mm-hmm.
and I think for the most part it was just like a personal adjustment. That where you're going through recognizing that my view of the world is just really small or really not very large and very just uninformed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I think it said I didn't associate it with. I mean, I heard that it was possibly a plot from somebody from the Russians were trying to assassinate him, or that it was but it was very difficult. All the signals seemed to be mixed, and there was just no way to say that it was one thing or another. And
right.
I believe that all the way through. I don't know what to believe about it,
mm-hmm.
other than the fact that it was a tragedy. And
sure.
Who knows? And it just made making any statement about the political situation at the time.
Right.
Uninformed. I mean, you couldn't really make anything. I felt really. I think devastated, but also where you don't really know which way to go necessarily, because there's no real, you don't have anything to base it on other than a lot of hearsay or what you think people want you to
mm-hmm.
understand.
Right.
Which is, it's very strange. I don't think I recovered from it necessarily. It wasn't the only thing that was causing that, because as I became more and more understanding of those forces in the world, you couldn't just step out and say, well, I know I believe this.
Mm-hmm.
And it made believing anything just
right.
really suspect.
Sure. All right. One of the other things I wanted to ask you about, what you mentioned a moment ago, you talked about Barry Goldwater and the politics. How did the politics play themselves out in the community, like in the church? And was the exchange between the different political views, was it fairly civil or not at times?
Well, there again, I think I was pretty sheltered.
Right. Okay.
The adults would have their functions where. I'm sure there was a lot of sort of political things that people do that you don't really recognize that that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I know we were asked to. I remember hearing from this Barry Goldwater partisan how he had asked my parents to either to contribute or to, you know, I think it was money or to either, or maybe even sign a statement. I don't know exactly what it was, but my folks just said, you know, he's a nice enough guy. We really want to not stomp on him for expressing his views, but we don't really want to be a part of what he's saying because it just didn't feel very socially acceptable or appropriate for being in a group of people who have a diversity of opinion.
Mm-hmm.
Because that, I mean, that, I think they just basically said we don't want to be that partisan.
Right.
And if that meant that there was going to be a schism in this church, they were going to stand by it. And I think, I'm not sure that my mother was more the powerful one there. My dad might have gone along with it, I think, at the time,
mm-hmm.
because he was a salesman. And that meant, you know, working with what the other person brought to the table.
Sure.
But my mom was more of the sort of the moral rock in the family.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. As far as the timeline goes, after you graduated from high school, did you go directly into the military at that time, or?
Yeah, I got out of school in June, and I worked at a grocery store during the summer, but I was pretty much committed to going
okay.
in the fall.
All right. What made you decide on the Air Force?
Well, I think there was a there were a number of things. One is it was probably the least likely to get me into combat.
Okay.
Because the Vietnam War was, they were just really increasing the staffing for that. The other thing was I had been down there at Edwards Air Force Base, so I had this real fascination with airplanes.
Okay.
And you know, I wasn't quite sure. My dad was in the Navy, so I wasn't quite sure that the Navy was what I wanted to do because I'd never been on boats for a long time. I'd always kind of been ground based.
Mm-hmm.
Never been on boats actually.
Right. Okay.
So I wasn't quite sure that the Navy, but I knew between those two that I would have the best chance of getting the, and I had an uncle who was an electronics engineer for one of the companies that supplied jets and rockets to the Air Force and the Navy.
Okay.
So he was kind of my vision of what I wanted to be when I grew up was an electrical engineer or electronics engineer.
All right. You mentioned about the possibility, about the Air Force, the least likely chance of going to combat. At this time, had you been paying attention to what was going on with the developments in Vietnam? And if so, did you feel that there was any chance that you'd be drafted?
Oh, I definitely knew I would be drafted. Mm-hmm. I definitely felt at that point that the potential was that I could be drafted.
Mm-hmm.
I think the big reason that I went into the service was I had not had a job that I knew would support me on the level that I was used to living with my folks.
Okay.
And without going to school, there was no question that I would not go to school, go to college.
Right.
But there was no way I was going to be able to afford to go to college if I didn't get any kind of scholarship or aid to go. And I had no thoughts at all of having some sort of a loan.
Right.
At that time. So it was like, when in making the choices there, the only thing that seemed to be right for me was, because I was not motivated to get a good job or a job that paid well enough, for fear of getting stuck in it, for one thing, but I think I was still really immature at that point. I mean, you look at some of the kids coming out of school now, and they seem to be a lot more aware of what's going on outside of their family. And at that time, I wasn't very aware. I think, like I say again, I was a pretty sheltered person. So when I did come out, it wasn't a done deal that you would get drafted right away, but the draft was in process. I mean, you still had to register for it, and you could get drafted. So
right.
It was much better to enlist.
Okay. All right. Where did you go for basic?
It was Lackland.
Lackland, okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the basic training?
The story I tell is that whenever I knew about 2 days in that I definitely wanted to go to college. it was like being homesick and going to camp. You know, you understood that you had you were in this social culture that was nothing that I'd ever experienced before.
Mm-hmm.
And there was not the things that I was used to, and it seemed that it was a lot more crass than I was used to. Meaning that everybody was sort of being their worst in working out how to be in that situation.
Okay.
So, you know, you knew that the sergeant that was responsible for your group was the person you had to please as far as listening to and responding to. And, you know, and I just tried to keep my head down as much as possible.
Right.
And do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have known the difference between I had gone through a Marine Corps devil pup type of a two-week camp or a week-long camp at when I was a junior in high school.
Okay.
And mostly that was, you know, a bunch of guys with a lot of testosterone that were hanging out trying to, you know, figure out who's going to be, where they were going to be in the social order,
mm-hmm.
the pecking order.
Right.
And I kept my head down and tried to just go along and figure out what the experience was about. And I was really pushing to get more. My big thing was I was not very well physically developed at that time. And so a lot of what I was dealing with was the aching abs and the shoulder muscles from doing push-ups. It up because they really pushed physical activity.
Right.
And the same thing was at basic too.
Okay. Did you go to the Marine camp to prepare you for basic?
It was something that my parents suggested because it was sort of something they saw in the newspaper, and they thought, well, this is something that you could do as one of the camps. You know, we went to camp in the YMCA during the summertime, and it was one great way for my parents to get rid of me. Not that they were that I was particularly bad, but I mean, it was a situation where it was a cheaper way for me to go and do stuff than sending me to some other big camp that was, you know, it was just a way to get out in the summertime and do stuff.
Right. Okay.
And since we were down, we were in Lancaster, California at the time, and this Devil Pup thing was in Camp Pendleton. So it was a bus trip to L.A. and back.
Okay.
For a week. And, you know, I think what they were doing is giving me, saying, okay, here's an experience outside of what you're going to see with us here in the family and with the YMCA. And
right.
It's not, they didn't feel like it was any kind of, they felt it was okay. It wasn't going to be, I don't know how much they weren't hoping that I would go into the Marine Corps, that's for sure.
Right, okay. All right.
I didn't feel like that I needed to go into the Marine Corps once I was there. Mm-hmm. I was just taking it as an experience to check out.
Okay. All right.
If anything, it made me feel less averse to doing something like that because I had the experience and knew I could get through it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So then did you feel that it in some ways helped to prepare you for basic?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think I was beginning to, I mean, my body was, at that time, was getting more built up and had the capacity to do that and not be just so blown away by it that I tried to avoid it. I mean, I got into doing the stuff, the physical activities and physical development activities without moaning and groaning about it or trying to avoid it.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me a little bit about the instructors at BASIC? How would they enforce discipline and that type of thing?
Well, there were, you know, drop and give me 5 or give me 10 or give me 15 or whatever if it was, if you had gotten into, if you missed the cue of what you were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, they were really pushing to get people through quite quickly. So, I remember there was only 3 or 4 times when I had really screwed up.
Okay.
And it was mostly because I missed the communication and didn't understand what they actually said.
Mm-hmm.
I never felt that I didn't really challenge the that I understand. I don't remember challenging the authority. I just sort of knuckled under and did what needed to be done to get through.
Right. Okay. All right.
The guy that I remember the guy's name. His name was Kalita. He was he was a southern white guy who I felt was, you know, he was fair. He mm-hmm. didn't really jump on anybody that didn't deserve it. And when he reprimanded me, that I remember, it was always with respect and just sort of a good solid nudge to, you know, stay aware of what's going on here, buddy. You're here for a reason.
Right.
And I always felt it was appropriate. I never felt that I was unfairly disciplined.
Okay. All right. Did you find the training you received here, did you find it sufficient for preparing you for the rest of your time in the military?
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think what I did in the military was I removed and replaced black boxes in electronic systems.
Okay.
On airplanes. And I don't think that I really needed a lot of discipline. I always felt it was very easy to give the military, to respect the military hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't really look for ways in which I never felt like I needed to challenge that. Everybody was trying to do a job that their rank, where that rank was respected, and I probably didn't recognize it, or maybe wouldn't have recognized it if they were abusing it. I think that was the big thing that we needed. I mean, what they assumed was that you were bringing a certain capacity to troubleshoot and hand-eye coordination to change out these black boxes, and so that really didn't require very much. You just had to when you weren't doing that stuff, not create a lot of problems by your other social stuff that you were doing.
Okay.
So I don't know if that answers that question, Murphy.
Yes, sir, it does. All right. Do you remember if there were any, well, I should phrase it this way, were there any memorable or humorous moments during basic that you can
basic
recall?
Training. Humorous. I felt it was kind of oppressive, mostly.
Okay, sure. All right. So after finishing your basic, at the end of basic, did they give you your MOS, and was it the one that you wanted?
I was just sort of going along.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't have an agenda, a big agenda there. I was glad that I had already qualified to work in the electronics field.
Mm, okay.
So I could have gone to radar, radio, or I know another couple other people, or electronic countermeasures, and I didn't have any sense that one of those was better than the other.
Okay.
So I ended up working on electronic compass systems and autopilots.
Okay.
And I thought it was, as I look back on it, it was probably as good, although radio might have been better. I wouldn't have known that at the time.
Mm, okay. All right. So where did you go to advanced training?
At Chanute in Illinois.
Okay. All right. Can you? Would you mind telling me a little bit about the training itself, and just maybe a little bit about a typical day in advanced training?
Yeah, we would. We'd have classes most of the day during the week, and we would first. It started out as electrical theory, and we would be doing circuit boards, and we'd work on a unit for a week, and then we'd have a test at the end of the week. And then that would took up two months. I think we did 8 months there. And then they started doing electronic theory.
Okay.
And then they did systems training for the systems we were likely to operate or to be repairing over the 8 month period. So it was an 8 month program, and we'd have most of our crew would be, or our, what they called them, flights, and there were 10 or 15 people, and there were 12 of them actually.
Okay.
We'd all live in the same barracks, and we would you'd have we'd have to walk to the school together as a flight, but when we were off there, we were pretty much free to do whatever we wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So there wasn't a lot of structure in our off school times, and nothing during the weekends.
Okay.
There weren't parades or anything like that that we had to perform in.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We didn't have to do any kitchen patrol, KP.
Mm-hmm.
It was really, it was pretty easy at that point. And I was surprised. When we took the tests, I was really, I really get a lot of, I want to really perform well in tests, and I ended up being the person who was able to get the best grades on the test.
Oh, wow, okay.
So I became the flight leader because of that.
All right.
And it wasn't something that, and I was kind of blown away by that because I thought there would be more, that the stuff would be harder, and it could have been a lot harder.
Mm-hmm.
My assessment at the time was that I could have done what I did when I got out of eighth grade before I even went into high school.
Oh, wow.
And it wasn't because I was particularly gifted, I don't think. I think anybody who had gone through eighth grade who was at all academically inclined could have gotten through it that way.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very, easy to understand. And if you were there to learn that stuff, then I don't think there would have been any problem with it.
Mm-hmm.
If you were an eighth grader.
Right.
So it was more a matter of just wanting to perform, I think, that got me through it on that level. I think everybody else in the flight had the capacity to do it. It's just that they weren't as motivated
mm-hmm.
to do it. And at times, you know, some of them, there was competition between us. It wasn't, and there were some people that just had it naturally, I think, and they came on towards the end. A lot of other people did really well in that sort of competitive atmosphere. But the way that the schooling was and the progress that you made through the theory of electrical theory and gave, you know, you could pick it up later if you didn't get it right at the first. So it was something that was constantly reinforced. And I thought it was good to get where we were going, but it wasn't good for much else other than what you would get in the first 4 years that they ask you to work.
Okay.
A lot depended on where you had to work, but if I had to go to a shop where I was the only person there, I don't know that I would have been able to do what was necessary to fix an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And once I got out of Chanute, they actually sent me to other tech schools where I would learn the particular or get more information about the system that I actually worked on.
Okay. All right. Did you enjoy learning about electronics?
I did. Up until the point where it got kind of abstract, and I mean, transistors, the electrical theory is kind of linear, whereas transistors become a little bit less, seem to be more complex. And I did have problems with that kind of stuff, I wasn't picking up on how to move beyond that more linear progression. But I liked it because it was something that I have since in my life spent a lot of time doing manual things and troubleshooting, both with automobiles and farm machinery, and And so, and electronics, like, we're kind of hooked up to in this whole world here.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have, it's more basic understanding, and I really appreciated having gone through it to get that. I did a lot of home wiring based on the information that I understood from that instruction. So I enjoyed figuring it out, and I certainly enjoyed the ideas, the practicality of it, or the functional aspect of what you were learning there, and how you could apply it through your whole life or through what you were doing.
Okay. All right. You mentioned other tech schools after this. Did they focus on specific aircraft, or was it more generalized at that point as well?
No, it was individual aircraft.
Okay.
I was working on C-130s at my first duty site. It was a weather squadron on Guam, and the C-130s were fairly new. They were switching over from tube-based amplifiers to transistors, and so the systems that were just a bit different.
Okay.
And they wanted to give us information about the transistor system that they were going to try to change everything out to. So we had both of them, and we could understand them.
Okay.
And I was also, the squadron was more of a transport. Well, Guam was a transport stopover place for all the stuff that was going to Vietnam. So we would also be fixing all the through the transport material or planes that were coming through. So some of those planes had different systems on them than we were trained on in tech school at Chanute.
Okay. All right. Did you receive, was all this training after advanced, was this all C-130s, or were there other planes as well?
Well, we worked on the C-141.
Okay.
And that was one of the, they shared the system with the C-130.
Okay.
The basic autopilot system, and I think it was the autopilot one. There was also a different compass on it as well. Yeah.
All right. I wanted to back up a moment, if you don't mind. You mentioned because you did so well on all the tests and everything that you became flight leader. Could you tell me about a little bit about that and what duties that entailed?
I think it was an attempt. Well, mostly what we did was we had to, where our flight was supposed to had responsibility for cleaning up or waxing the floors or taking care of the areas that we were using. The flight leader was supposed to sort of dole out the chores, like who's going to do what, or let's make sure we do this and have the quality control thing. But it really wasn't, as far as other privileges, I can't remember what value was there, but there wasn't a lot of, with the group that we had, I think the things that we needed to do were not of a nature that we got in trouble if we didn't do it right.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't remember ever getting in hot water or anything for not having the guys all do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was rare. I don't remember there being any huge benefits from being the flight leader.
Okay.
Other than just recognition of doing well on the test.
Right. All right. After you finished the advanced training, how many more schools did you go to?
This initial one was, I think it was 1 month.
Okay.
In it was in Okinawa for the C-130. And beyond that, actually, I don't remember any others.
Okay.
We might have had a couple of them that were where they came to us and did a couple of weeks. But I don't remember.
All right. Okay, then. Well, after you completed the school at Okinawa, were you then given your first, I guess, assignment at post training?
Yeah,
that was
on Guam.
Right. Okay. All right. And about when was this, timeline wise? About.
Well, let's see. It was in the summer of 65.
Okay.
Yeah. See, the Chinook was 8 months from September or October. I went in on September 9th. I only had, I think it was only 5 weeks at basic, so I was in Chinook from October to April.
Okay.
May. And then I went to Guam, and they sent me to Okinawa.
Okay.
I came back, and then I was there on Guam for 2 years total.
Okay.
18 months, excuse me. That was an 18-month thing. Weird thing is I went back to Guam at the end of my period, at the end of my tour duty.
Okay.
4 years. For what I was in the Strategic Air Command at that point.
All right.
So that was another 6 months.
Okay.
Anyway, so I was on Guam for a total of 2 years.
Okay. All right. After you completed your training, did they give you any free time, or was it report to duty immediately?
Oh, from between Chinook and I think I had a couple of weeks.
Okay.
In Guam, and then Guam was a solid year and a half. I never got off the island except to go to Okinawa. Or excuse me. That was, you know, I want to be sure here. If I said I went to tech school in Okinawa, I meant to say Japan.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I misspoke there.
Oh, no, that's all right. No problem. All right. Once you received your orders that you were going to Guam, and that's where you knew you were going, what did you think of it? What did you think of the assignment?
Well, the guys in my flight had been, the other orders had been to, there were a couple that had gone to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
a couple that were other places in the States, and I was the only one that got shipped to Guam, and there were some that went to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So we were just kind of spread out all over the place, and I was kind of glad that I was going to Guam. Everybody else said, I don't want to go to Guam.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know why I want to go to Guam, other than the fact that I wasn't particularly interested in going to Europe, and I didn't want to go to Vietnam at the point. So I didn't recognize or realize what going to Guam would have meant at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt sort of ambivalent about it, but most in general felt good.
Okay. All right. How did you get there? Was it by commercial airliner or military transport?
It was commercial. It was under charter from the military. It was a chartered airplane.
Okay. All right. And you mentioned it being a stopover point. So were there guys on the plane that were then continuing on to Vietnam as well?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. What was the attitude on like on the plane? Were people talking about Vietnam and, I guess, talking about what was ahead for them?
I don't remember.
Okay. All right.
And I don't remember, you know, if I think it was all branches of the military were using that
okay.
at the time. So some of them were, might have been just going to the Philippines
mm-hmm.
as well, because that was kind of the next stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Was there any sort of in processing when you arrived there? What was arrival like? And you know and going to your new unit?
You know, it was very low-key because it was a weather squadron. Mm-hmm. It wasn't particularly... there was already... I mean, there, at the time I was there, they had... The B-52s were there as well that
okay.
were bombing from Guam. They were flying over from Guam. And so as a weather squadron, we were kind of on the side watching everything else go on.
Mm-hmm.
And although we were, they were, the weather squadron was looking for hurricanes, and the island had been hammered pretty hard in a couple of years before, and there had been a lot of rebuilding of the place, so it made, the, you know, understanding the weather pretty valuable
mm-hmm.
at the time. But for us, there were, my shop only had three, well, at the time, it was only two people in the autopilot shop. And the guy that was above me was a, had three stripes, and I was only one stripe at the time, so it was pretty low-key.
Okay.
We were mostly on standby. Because there wasn't always work to do. That we didn't have a lot of aircraft, and the aircraft we had were fairly new, so they weren't breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
And where we worked mostly, where I ended up working mostly, was on the swing shift, and it was on standby. So the what I did most of that first year was I would show up in the afternoon and see if there was anything that still had to be fixed. And if not, I would not, I'd just put my, make sure they had my phone number where I could be reached and tell them where I was going to be, and I would leave.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't go to work. I wouldn't have to be in the shop if there wasn't any work to do.
Right.
They didn't have us doing other stuff. They just had this shop staffed as if they might have, you know, in for the worst case scenario.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Otherwise, I don't remember much about how I was, what the orientation was like.
Okay.
I do know that, you know, once a month we had the whole squadron go in and watch the Air Force news. On that, you know, they would send a reel of what's going on in the theater
mm-hmm.
around every month or so, and we have to go watch that.
Okay. All right. Outside of, I guess, outside of hurricane hunting, did the planes and the squadron have other responsibilities as well?
As far as I understood it, they didn't.
Okay.
Like I say, we were responsible for all these transit military airplanes that came through.
So okay.
We had similar systems, we would be asked if they had problems to try to fix them, because the folks who were flying across the Pacific really wanted their autopilots to work.
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't have to be flying them all the time.
Sure. Okay.
And so I would be working on C-130s and C-124s, and didn't really work on any of the larger planes, the C-141s at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They were fairly large, they were, even though they're dwarfed by the C-5. But we ended up, mostly it was those older planes that had things on them that were almost like analog to digital, that they just were things that wore out, and so we would repair them when they came through.
Okay. All right.
But I don't think there was anything that, nothing that I knew about. Now, there was certainly the potential for other more secret stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But around Guam, well, Guam had a fairly heavy naval presence and naval air as well as a dry dock.
Okay.
So I would expect that a lot of that patrolling would be done by them.
Okay. All right. Could you describe in a little more detail the air base itself and a little bit about your quarters and all?
Yeah. The air base, well, it's a coral island, and we were on one end of the island from the naval air base and the naval water bases were south, or if I remember correctly, they were south on the island at the other end. And so, and we had, there was a very nice beach associated with the base. And it was big enough to, that you could, that they had a lot of, I think there was twin runways, plus there were a lot of B-52 pads where they could, you know, park them, and they're pretty well, you know, they were distributed all over the Air Force, all over the base, the flight line. And there was also, you know, they had the capacity to deal with all this international, this transit traffic as well. So it's a fairly large base. A lot of the quarters were cement because the hurricanes had knocked down all the Quonset huts, or the corrugated steel type buildings, infrastructure, and so a lot of them had been built up with cement and were built with louvered windows so the air would blow through. And we had rooms where there were six people could live in, six beds, but oftentimes at the time that I was there, they weren't totally full. It was built like dorm rooms where you have a central bathroom and with beds on both sides, and all of your lockers had heating elements in it to keep the place from getting real musty because it was very high humidity there. But there wasn't, the weather was such that you didn't really need to have a solid window or a solid wall because the temperature just never got down low enough that you needed it to keep the heat inside. So it was tropical. And because all of that was fairly new, it had been rebuilt since the initial infrastructure had been blown down, the quality of them, of the barracks were very, and they were oftentimes 3 stories high or 2 stories high.
Okay.
pretty nice. As the war progressed, when I came back the second time, there was a lot of temporary type buildings that were put up that were basically corrugated or steel buildings that were low. They were just single story with almost like hospitals where you have just a long open bays with people in beds adjacent to each other, and foot lockers for carrying your for storing your material, your stuff, gear. I always felt that it was quite nice. The food was great. Even though some people would say at the that it wasn't, it was fine for me. I never really got sick while I was there. I was probably in the prime of my physical condition because I really didn't. The work was not that stressful, and most of the time when I was off work, I was either swimming at the beach or swimming in the pool or playing handball or something like that. So
okay.
It was like I was at the country club.
Right. All right.
The facilities were great.
Yeah. Okay.
There just weren't any women there.
Right. All right. You mentioned the weather and hurricanes knocking down the buildings and stuff in the pad, the Quonset huts and all. Was there any weather issues, hurricanes or tropical storms? Did any of that come through when you were there?
There were some near misses, but nothing where they just moved all the planes off because they weren't quite sure that they could predict the path of it.
Mm.
There were times when it seemed like the rain was going sideways, but nothing. We never had any direct hits while I was there.
Okay. All right. Could you tell me about the people of Guam? Did you have much contact with them?
No, I didn't. I have to say, I understood from various people that if you lived off base and you got to know the local people, that they really, it was pretty easy for them to, easy to be integrated in their little society, and they would often have fiestas that people would go to. But I never really was in that kind of a position, especially on my first tour there. I had friends who lived off base who felt that they were very nice people. But I understood that a lot of guys are just trying things out, and a lot of times there were stories of if you didn't go down, if you went downtown on your own, you really took your life in your hands in that sense. But I think you had to try to exploit them before they would do that. You had to try to exploit the natives before they would actually come back at you on that level.
Sure.
But there at the time, there was so much military that we were overwhelming them at the time when I was there. And so it made sense that there would be some animosity. And I just never was in a position to either feel it or understand it, the level of it. I went to the beach a lot. There were natives, Guamanians, who were actually operating the concessions, and they were, they were always really open and positive to the people that were their customers. And the one big thing where I had a very strong connection was they had a Guamanian lifeguard at a pool on the base, And I was, at the time, trying to figure out how far I could swim underwater without, you know, going up for breath. And I actually passed out underwater.
Oh, wow.
The guy pulled me out and resuscitated me. And so I was very, felt really gracious about that, or gratitude, with a lot of gratitude about that. That was worthwhile.
Sure.
So I didn't have any negative feelings about the locals. I just felt really sorry that they were being so, their culture was being totally overrun by us.
All right.
Not that it hadn't been overrun by a lot of people before.
Sure.
I mean, the Japanese were very, the Japanese had been through there pretty heavily, and the Spanish had been through there before that, and, you know, we've been through there a couple of times.
With all this influence from other cultures, American culture, Japanese and Spanish, could you, I know you didn't have too much contact with them, but could you get a sense that, I mean, of their culture, could you, was there a sense of it? Was
No, not that I would be able to. I mean, I think I had preconceived ideas based on it being a tropical island culture. Could be similar to Hawaiians or other Tahitians or some, you know, the other things, the other ideas that were set by understanding that there were island cultures that were more laid back and sort of more organic and less technological than we are. I think in some cases, or in a lot of cases, that was there, but I think that they were also affected quite a bit by the other, and I didn't really, like I say, I didn't get exposed to that at all while I was there. I was pretty much insulated on the base.
Okay. All right. You mentioned a little earlier that about once a month you guys would watch Air Force films about what was going on in the war. Can you talk a little bit about that, and did you guys, what did you guys think of the films, and did you talk about them?
I think it, we did talk, there were, I think people were starting to realize that there were there was questioning about what we were doing and whether or not we were going to be successful, and how much these shows could actually create that illusion. But it was obvious after a while, in the, over that period of 18 months, that we really, number one, they weren't able to give us the information that would actually give us a sense of that.
Okay.
They could show a lot of things being blown up and a lot of napalm.
Right.
But they still, you know, they also said that there were people that were getting shot down, and there were people that, where bases were being overrun. It wasn't that they were hiding that much from us that we could tell, but certainly the emphasis was on, we're doing what we know how to do there. And although, you know, we're not done yet. As the way we could talk about it, I don't think anybody felt that they could stand up and say, no, this is all bullshit, you know, this is not right. There wasn't anybody who was willing to do that or ready to do that. I think everybody was just sitting there saying, well, we're not winning. How do we deal with that?
Mm-hmm.
There's no we can't really take anything away from this other than, well, we got to keep on going, slogging through it.
Right. Okay. Lynn, had you, based on what you had seen and the conversations you'd had with other guys there at Guam, had you begun to develop an opinion about the war at that point, or was it still too not clear enough at that point?
I think on the first tour, it was certainly not clear.
Okay.
I was just sort of in the sort of information gathering.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't a strong need to get clear because I wasn't being threatened by decisions being made by above what's going on above. I wasn't being threatened by it.
Mm-hmm.
I was just going through doing what I was told and making sure that I didn't get in trouble by not doing those things.
Right.
As people were talking about it, there was a variety. I think some people were feeling that they understood that it was kind of a wash as to what we were doing,
mm-hmm.
as to how we were, how successful we were, and there were some. I didn't ever feel there was any kind of. I didn't get a clear picture of how other people felt about the sort of the righteousness of what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
I think people were not. There were a lot of people either were not talking about it or they were. It just didn't make. They didn't know. They were at a job, and that's. They were just doing their job. They had a job. They had some security there, so they were going to keep making that happen as well as they could. We weren't affected by it that much on Guam, and we actually, as a weather squadron, we kind of kept apart from the guys who were working on the bombers, who might have had more of a say-so or more of an idea, but that's still pretty remote.
Mm-hmm.
To working on the B-52s.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, before we move on to Okinawa, is there anything else we should mention about Guam? Any memorable moments or anything like that before moving on?
I thought it was a beautiful place, and I've always, because I've spent so much time there, whenever Guam is mentioned in the news, I kind of, my ears perk up.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the beach was terrific. I mean, the fact that we were able to go to the beach and enjoy that, it was fantastic. But I spent a lot of time there dreaming about what would happen back in the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very aware that there were things going on in the States because I read a lot. I listened to the radio, which had some pretty, what I thought, you know, it wasn't shut down that much. There was a lot of music coming across that was telling the story, and they really, it would have been very difficult to shut that off.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time I spent there in a very material pursuit, going after new stereo equipment, and that was a big thing during that time. Everybody felt that they needed to have the sounds, and they needed to have a great camera, and I spent a lot of time and energy researching and talking and spine, those kinds of things. When I think about the idea of, that was my most, that's been my greatest near-death experience, was in the pool there, but that seems rather ridiculous relative to what other things were going on in Vietnam at that time, as far as insignificance. I had a coworker who burned up in a car accident that was pretty, he was very, I had a lot of respect for him and his worldview. I think it was very ambivalent about the war, and but he made a mistake when he was working on his car, and he ended up getting airlifted to the Philippines burn unit to try to in hopes that he would, they had the technology to help him survive, but he died anyway. So that was the closest I came to any death in the military, too. The other thing was working on aircraft that had been sprayed with Agent Orange.
Okay.
It was very sticky inside the aircraft. And also working on aircraft that had helicopters that had been shot up in the cargo bay. That just kind of brought the war to me that way.
Sure.
You know, the other thing that was amazing was you'd see some of these transport planes that were bringing back caskets, and they wouldn't leave them in the plane during the day. They would bring them out and put them on the deck on the flight line because it was too hot in the airplanes. And that was that gave me a lot of pause for thinking, you know, for and then there was one good thing is I saw it, they had a U-2 drop in there one day, and then it took off, and that was pretty fantastic to watch.
Sure. Bet.
My second tour is with when I worked for the Strategic Air Command, working on the bombers, was a bit different because I had more information.
Okay.
We can talk about that later.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. All right. One thing I wanted to ask you, a moment ago you mentioned the music and the message that it was sending and how that couldn't be blocked out. Was there any particular song or songs that that really spoke to you or influenced your opinion?
Oh, probably all the ones. I would say the songs that talked about the drug experience as opposed to the anti-war or how it led to anti-war experience. I think there were a number of those, and or questioning the status quo or questioning the the folks that were running the country at the time. There were a lot of them. I just have a lot of flashes in my head. So any one in particular, Jimi Hendrix would be one. I mean, I don't think he necessarily said anything particular about the war itself, but he did talk about questioning the way in which people had been viewing the world and the U.S.'s, or any individual that makes up the U.S., United States, or any culture, for that matter, that has, you know, where's the source of what you're doing, of your behavior? And there were lots of others during that time.
Okay.
And then I was just new to jazz, and at the time, jazz didn't really say anything about the war necessarily, but it did question sort of the dominant paradigm, to speak about it in those kind of jargon-type terms. So I was, like I say, I went in very naive. I came out a little bit less naive, maybe. I don't know. Just differently experienced.
Okay. All right. After you left Guam, did you go directly to Okinawa, or was there anywhere else in between?
Actually, I was stationed at Riverside.
Okay.
And that was a SAC base.
Okay.
So they had the B-52s and the KC-135s to refuel them. And they changed air commands over there on Guam, they would send the B-52s there, and they would send the KC-135s to Okinawa for refueling them. And so my first station from Riverside was to go to Fort Worth, Texas.
Okay.
To work in a shop there where they were actually over there on Guam and Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And basically I worked there for, I think it was a six-month tour of duty. And mostly what I did was go around to various bars in Texas. And, I don't know. I don't remember much about working on the base there.
Okay. While you were back there in the States, did you notice any changes? You're talking about this questioning of authority, rise of counterculture, if you will, whatever. Did you notice changes at that point from when you had, before you had gone to Guam?
Well, you have to realize that the Central Valley of California is quite different from Riverside in its sort of access to that. I did notice the changes mostly because I was listening to the music. It's definitely different. I'd been away for a year and a half, and I was just gobbling up the culture that was available down there. So I was going to car races, and I was going. I mean, it was the culture that was really pulling me in there.
Okay.
And as far as the way that people were relating to us, I never felt. I never was confronted as a military person about what was going on in Vietnam. I never tried to project it either, that I was a military person. I didn't emphasize that, and I still spent most of my time with military people. I didn't really integrate with the local culture there in Riverside.
Okay.
Because almost immediately, I got sent to Fort Worth. And then when I came back from there, I was almost immediately sent to Okinawa.
Okay.
And then when I got back from Okinawa, I was almost immediately sent to Guam again, working with them, working with their military, with the bombers on Guam. So I didn't. I was in there only in Riverside as a transition, and I didn't get very much experience with the local culture personally. Although I did observe it a lot in going around to various places, but mostly I was just looking at the women, or trying to put myself in a situation where there might be a possibility that, you know, I could find some, you know, have some female interaction. But the problem was that I was also a military person, and it made it very, I think at the time, we were kind of, like I say, we weren't confronted about it, but I didn't really feel I felt alienated from the culture just a bit for that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would imagine, you know, I'm not quite sure how much I was being affected by the fact that a lot of the culture, a lot of the people in my peer group that were outside the military were thinking that Vietnam was not the right, you know, the peace movement, or that they were associated or aligned with the peace movement. I don't remember feeling very much about that. It just didn't have an impact on me. I was certainly aware of the fact that there was something like that going on, and that it was college. A lot of the universities were sort of the hotbed of that kind of information or that kind of effort. And my identity was that I was going to go to college afterwards, so I was looking at that idea, that identity, or where I was looking for reasons why they would choose to think the way that they thought, and looking at that. But I don't think it was very, I was never really, it didn't, hadn't formed in such a way or set or gelled in such a way that I needed to change my behavior,
mm-hmm.
other than understanding that I was only going to have to go to September of 68. I wasn't going to re-up.
Right.
I think I knew I wasn't going to re-up, like I said earlier. At 3 days in, I knew I was going to be in only for 4 years, and that was it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, after being at... back, you said you were back in the States, what, about 6 months before being sent to Okinawa?
Then I went to, I think, there might have been a month in between each of those deployments.
Okay. All right. And what was the unit you were assigned to in Okinawa?
Well, it was still the Riverside Squadron.
Okay.
And, so they were, they had their KC-135s on Okinawa,
mm-hmm.
and they would fly down to refuel the bombers flying out of Guam. So part of our group was in Guam taking care of the bombers, and part of our group was in Okinawa taking care of the KC-135s.
Mm-hmm.
So... That's what was happening there.
Okay. Was your job the same, pretty much the same as in Guam?
Yeah, they had similar systems.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, I got on. I I really tried to avoid where I could working on the day shift, and I was really open to working on the evening. So I worked the swing shift usually, and oftentimes was working on standby because there wasn't anything to do. There would be a launch that we would have to staff.
Mm-hmm.
When they were all, you know, all the bombers would launch all at once, and then the refuelers would have to launch in response to that. And so we would have to be available for the launch because they would sometimes they would run into problems on their taxi,
mm-hmm.
and we would have to repair them on the taxi runway, and then or they would be they'd scratch them and put somebody else in their place or put another plane in the place, but they would run more planes up than were necessary in order to make sure they had enough to refuel. And then we would so we'd have to staff those, and that a lot depended on when they launched, so we weren't sure when to do that, when we were going to actually be called on to be on this launch. And that usually we slept on that too, because unless there was any work to be done, we were just sitting in an truck on the flight line waiting to go around to the various planes.
Okay.
The thing that I remember most about Okinawa was or my service related aspect. I mean, there was an awful lot of things off base that weren't happening in Guam, because Okinawa was a lot more run by, the base itself was run by the local people. There's a lot of civilian employees on the base. So we had houseboys that would, if you paid them extra, they would clean your room, they'd wash your clothes. They didn't have any of that on Guam.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Do your own. The food was a lot different. It was local, but it was because the base was had been established a lot longer. The food was better,
mm-hmm.
on Okinawa. And there was a lot more integration of the local folks on the base than there was in Guam, because it wasn't so isolated. Then there were a lot more people on Okinawa.
Okay. All right. What was your impression of the people of Okinawa, and could you get an impression, or could you get a feel for what they thought of the American presence there?
I think they were say, Jason, just a second here.
Sure.
I need to take a little break.
Sure, no problem.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Sure, no problem.
The Okinawans were because I got out a little bit more, I was feeling a lot more confident at that point to go out and visit in the countryside. I did take some trips, and for the most part, I felt they were tolerant of us, of me in particular. I didn't feel any animosity there at all.
Mm-hmm.
I did feel a bit of a predatory thing, because I understood I was money for them. I mean, it was a way for them to we injected a lot of money into their economy, and so there was some bit of predatory thing there, in that they were if I was interested in buying something, they were right there, and if I wasn't, I was just kind of Okay, well, they're here.
All right.
But, you know, for the, I think they had, I got the impression that there was, they could have, there were places that were not as affected by us as others, and that they were going on about their life okay, although it seemed, you know, it seemed a little bit impoverished, but definitely outside the base, at each of the entrances to the base, there was this economy based on, you know, drinking and girls and buying of electronic and clothes and stuff like that. So you had to run that gamut to get outside of that influence and see what was on going on in the countryside.
Right.
So they and I got the impression that it was worse around the Army bases than it was around the Air Force base, but I don't imagine it was much, that there was much difference there.
Mm-hmm. All right. When you weren't on duty, aside from going out to the countryside and seeing people and getting to see a little bit of Okinawa, besides that, what would you do in your free time in Okinawa?
Well, I was still in my acquisition mode there.
Okay.
I was buying stereo and camera equipment. I was also using them. I mean, I was shooting, taking pictures of the countryside and the local people and the markets and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I and we could develop them on base. There was a photo development thing on base, and then I did a lot of sport type things, like I was very much into handball at the time.
Okay.
And there was a track that I used to, you know, work on my physical development. I was running and doing sit-ups and things like that, and I played a lot of pool and ping pong.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I went to movies. So I actually tried to go to school. They had a night school on the base that you could go to, and I wasn't very I started out in this very dry course of business law, and I kind of bailed on it. I just didn't stick. Probably made me not want to be a lawyer for a long time.
Right.
In any case. And I, you know, I came into the military, and even all the way through being in, on Guam, the first 18 months, I was not, I never drank.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't into drinking, and I wasn't into smoking. I never smoked cigarettes, or dope. At that time, up until that time, so I was staying out of that. It's like I didn't get caught up in it. I knew a lot of people while I was in Guam and Okinawa who just would get real, as the expression was, they'd get shit-faced, and they'd have to be, you know, hauled back onto base in a pretty rotten condition. And I never did that.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was in Okinawa, I had some friends take me out, and we did have a little bit of, you know, a few drinks, and it wasn't something where I went overboard. I didn't get real drunk. I just started experimenting with it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
It wasn't something that I didn't really get pukey drunk until I got back to the United States.
Right.
And I didn't start smoking pot till after I got out of service.
Okay. Did you notice, was there, I know you touched on this briefly, but was there concerns with drug use and drug issues in Guam or Okinawa?
I never saw it.
Okay.
The only drug that I saw being abused was alcohol and cigarettes.
Okay.
And it could have been, I don't know why people didn't, if it was there, why they didn't try to offer it to me. I'm not quite sure why. I didn't feel like I was a goody two-shoes on that at all, you know,
right.
like that. I would have exposed them at all, but it could be that it just, they were keeping it pretty low profile at that point. And I don't know. I'm not quite sure why I didn't see it, but I really didn't see it till I got out.
Okay. All right. What about racial issues in Guam and Okinawa? Did you ever notice any problems with between racial issues?
I didn't. I was raised to be pretty. Be very tolerant, actually, and to be sort of hyper vigilant about it. But I didn't have any experience with it either, where I was in the room with them or had to work with them. And on Guam, I actually had a black roommate that was from New York, I think, and we didn't develop a very close friendship. And I had real issues with his saxophone playing, which was pretty bad. But I, like I say, I was hyper vigilant about not really being about being a, you know, I didn't want to do any behavior that felt like it was racist. So I tolerated it as best I could, and we negotiated times when he could play in the room and I'd be out.
Right.
But beyond that, and I had a black supervisor when I was in Riverside. I don't remember having I didn't feel any negativity towards him, other than the fact that he sold me a car that I blew up almost right away. But that's neither here nor there.
Right.
It could have been my fault, too.
Yeah.
But, you know, and he tried to get me to re-up, and I was at a point where I said, look, I don't really want to re-up. But he was probably my most, he and my roommate on Guam were probably the most intense interaction I had with blacks during my time there. So I think that the Air Force was kind of almost lily white at that point.
Okay.
I really didn't have any in my flight. There was no blacks in my or any other race, should I say. The Latinos were not in the service at the time either. None that I did stick out in my mind. So it was mostly a bunch of white kids that I was with. And I didn't feel that we were under any kind of a lot of stress that would have really exacerbated those racial sort of political things that would have happened. So I didn't feel that that was, and there weren't any special programs that were very blatant that I remember in the service. You know, where people were out saying, "Look, you need to, we need to respect each other." I don't remember that. I'm sure it was happening. I didn't feel any. I don't remember any racial program, anti-racial programs, or racist or anti-bigotry programs, for that matter.
Okay. All right. back to Okinawa and your time there, is there anything else we need to say about that before before moving on to Guam and your final 6 months there?
I can't think of anything else there. I know that it was farther along in my career in the Air Force,
mm-hmm.
and I was a lot more comfortable learning or exposing myself to new things there.
Okay.
So time, I was feeling a lot more confident about my own personal self. I think that was the deal. And it was quite a nice duty. It was, for me, it was great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there was anything. The only other thing, I mean, I did have a very, really high point in my technology use for my job.
Okay.
And it was we had to swap out a compass system on a KC-135.
Mm-hmm.
You have to calibrate them on a compass rose, and it means that you sit up and you have somebody on the ground move the plane around in the four quadrants, or as you're working around the 360 degrees, and then you adjust the compass system so that it nulls out all the extraneous circles, magnetic fields.
Okay.
And that was, I did that at night. In the middle of, it started early in the morning, actually, about 1 or 2 o'clock, and went to about 6. So I don't operate very well at night anyway, but it was a fairly high, I remember it a lot. And from my understanding, it was successful, and that really made a big difference, too.
Okay. All right. After you finished at Okinawa, did you go back to the States again for a short time before being assigned to Guam, or was it straight to Guam?
It was, there was a short time in Riverside.
Okay, that's right. All right. All right. And this new assignment in Guam with SAC, how did the job differ there?
Well, the B-52 has much the same system, but it has some backup systems. One is most of the compass systems, when you think about compass systems, they're based on the Earth's magnetic field, and they had one that locked on stars, the bombers did. That was something that I didn't have any experience in. And fortunately, I wasn't the only guy in the shop, because somebody else did most of that work. But I would be able to work on the old compass systems, which they left. I mean, the magnetic field compass systems and the automatic pilot. For the most part, I really didn't have anything to do there. I did work there, but in the 6 months that I was there, actually I think I ended up being there 9 months. No, it was only six, because I was only on Guam for 2 years total. Sorry. Most of the time I remember there was, again, I worked on the night shift. Again, I worked on launches. if they needed to be fixed, the planes needed to be fixed, we'd work on it on the launch. And if they came back broken or they came back from, and we would do some debriefing of the flight crew when they came back in, they would be, that way we could figure out whether or not, or how, get some more information about how to troubleshoot their system. I didn't get a lot of experience working during that time.
Okay.
Because the planes were pretty solid, they were hanging together better. I did spend a lot of time driving the truck out on the launch for people, and we would have all the electronic shops working out of that same truck, so we'd be driving back and forth on the launch, on the flight line, to the various planes that were sitting ready to go on the launch. Other than that, I spent a lot of time at the beach again, a lot of the time thinking about buying stuff, records and material. The people, I was a lot more experienced at, I had a lot more friends during that time. They were the same people that I knew in Riverside and had been building friendship circle in Riverside. And there were starting to be some more ideas about more drinking for me. And there was an awful, there were quite a few more discussions about whether or not what we were doing there was appropriate. And if it's not, what would we do about it? You know, how are we going to do it? How are we going to deal with this? Where are we going to, and since we were getting close to being out, a lot of guys were talking about going back to school and what was going to happen at that point. So they were focused more on what they were going to do after they were out than what they were doing when they were in.
All right.
And because we were on Guam and we were very remote from actual combat, there were people who were questioning bombing at the time a lot more than when I was there the first time, because I was working with the crews that were working on the bombers and in that group of people.
Okay. Was this 1968 at this time?
Yeah.
Okay. Had you talked about people beginning to question things more. Had the Tet Offensive and what had happened in 68, had that played a part in this I guess, more pronounced feeling of questioning what was going on?
Well, you know, I, at this point, understanding the timeline is... I don't associate the Tet Offensive with any particular timeline with me in the military.
Okay.
If that, in fact, I mean, given that that was going on, it could have been that there was a lot more questioning of it. I think it came, even in the Air Force newspaper, it came around for the Pacific. They were actually talking about it in an ambivalent way,
mm-hmm.
about what we were doing there.
Okay.
And we were also getting different movies, or movies that were addressing or thinking about that differently as well. I mean, the movies and the songs, again, were... people were picking up on that culture that was going on in the States that was questioning what we were doing in Vietnam. And I'm sure everybody was talking, you know, it was coming from people, well, since we'd been in Riverside, stationed in Riverside, there was a lot of information out there in that area that was coming in to us, brought in by individuals. It wasn't necessarily coming in through any kind of media.
Mm-hmm.
Or they were transferred in. And so there, it was just, I think people were feeling that there was such an ambivalence in the culture about why we were there and what we were actually doing. I can remember a few conversations with people who were just, they were very conflicted, and in some cases they were just said, this is ridiculous. What are we doing here? And there just wasn't. There were people that I respected for just being conscious about stuff and being willing to talk about things on a more intellectual level.
Mm-hmm.
But we obviously had the benefit of not having to defend ourselves. We were pretty remote from Vietnam itself, from the theater there. The only thing we never lost an aircraft that I knew of.
Mm-hmm.
Although there were B-52s lost over there. We never did.
Mm-hmm.
And we dumped. I mean, we saw them loading those aircraft all the time with those bombs. So it was something that we could think about in the abstract. And it caused, I think, quite a bit of concern,
mm-hmm.
you know, in combination with all the other things that we were hearing and listening to.
Sure.
Or to question about what actually was going on and what was our purpose there.
Mm-hmm.
So you heard people just talking about, the only thing they talked about was when they were getting out.
Right. Okay. Was this assignment at Guam, was this your last stint with the military?
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. Well, before we move on to post-military, is there anything else we should say about Guam or about your military service?
I really felt there was one thing that was going on at the time. There's a couple things. One is there was a huge sort of counter measure going on. It's called Pride.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in Riverside there was a this huge banner on the control tower that said Pride, and it just stuck in my craw all the time because I could feel that there wasn't much in the way of pride in what our mission was.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I looked back on it, the more I recognized that they were fighting that pretty heavily from a standpoint of humans just have real tough time when they're ambivalent about things. They really can't perform or do what the mission is very easily if they don't feel strongly about it. And it always felt to me that it was so contrived. They didn't have it from within. People didn't have it. They were trying to manufacture it.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt a little alienating as well for me. The other thing that I felt was that if a person came into the service very relatively healthy mentally, like their attitude is good and they didn't have a lot of problems with getting through The system was built to take care of a person's needs very well.
Mm-hmm.
And at least their physical needs and in a lot of cases their mental needs, in the sense that they've got a lot of things to sort of soak up your energy when you're not working. And then when you are working, there's quite a bit of good support for making sure that that happens well. I was very well taken care of when I had my incident with the near drowning. That was, and I felt that people were very solicitous of me, and they just didn't. They did watch to make sure I wasn't trying to kill myself, because a lot of guys were trying to get off the island by injuring themselves. So I felt well cared for while I was in the service. And subsequent to the service has been the same thing.
Okay. All right. When you returned home, did you follow what was going on with the war closely through the media?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't watch a lot of television. Mm-hmm. I went to the movies. I did. So, you know, I saw The Deer Hunter and all the other those types of movies. Listened to the music. And I went to school.
Okay.
I did go to the started right off in Riverside City College.
All right.
And I got I took a lot of lower division classes, which are pretty much, you know, college entry. Let's see what you're thinking. Let's get you to put it down on paper. But also there were there was a social I don't want to say socialist, but there was a couple of people that were instructors there that were trying, that definitely increased my ambivalence towards the bureaucracy or the United States as a political power in the world. And so plus I started smoking pot at the time, so I was definitely open to persuasion.
Was there much, you talked about the professors and their perspective on things, but was there much protest or anti-war activity among the students at that time?
Yeah, there at Riverside City College, no, there wasn't that I could tell. I mean, I wasn't wasn't focused on it.
Mm-hmm.
I had a pretty tight group of folks that I worked with that were ex-military that all came out and went back to school kind of at the same time. But they had girlfriends and all, but it was more a matter of, I was focused on what do you need to do to get through college at the time. I wasn't really focused on these extraneous activities that would constitute like anti-war activities. I think I was aware of them because I was interested in them, but I didn't join them.
Okay.
I didn't get into going along with them. I did, you know, I was aware of the fact that there was a fairly large, heavy cultural influence of the hippie groups and just drugs in general, and how that affected people's openness to understanding that there might be a different way of looking at things than what was going on at the national level or on the political front, where we would think it was worthwhile to have war. So I was questioning that, but I didn't really get into organized protest.
Okay. What did you study while you were there at Riverside?
I was just doing lower division.
Okay, right. Yeah, sorry.
But I was very much affected by this. It was a sort of a social look at. It was lower division social. Oh, I'm missing the name. Social science, anyway.
Okay.
And it just really hit home. I didn't get the impression this guy was had a particular axe to grind other than just opening people's ideas. And it was something I hadn't heard before, so it was kind of impressive.
Right. Once you finished at Riverside, where did you go from there?
I went to I moved north, closer to where my folks were living at the time, which was Stockton, California.
Mm-hmm.
I went to San Joaquin Junior College in Stockton, and was there for a quarter, and then I transferred up to Columbia Junior College in the foothills near Sonora. And I was, I was in the marijuana culture at that time, pretty much. But I also was the person who made enough money to make sure that the rent was paid.
Right.
And I was using the GI Bill to go to school.
Okay. What type of job were you working?
When I first got out in Riverside, I was working as in an aluminum anodizing plant.
Okay.
And then when I moved to Stockton, I worked in a plastic pipe extrusion plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked at the post office for the Christmas rush, the packages. And when I moved up to the Forest Service, I worked at the Forest Service when I was in Columbia, at the Columbia Junior College.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's kind of what I was shooting for. When I was getting close to the end of my lower division requirements, and I was doing pre-forestry.
Okay. All right. Is that what you ended up sticking with, or did your goals change over time?
What happened was I needed to move to a four-year college,
mm-hmm.
and the one big forestry school was in Humboldt, at Humboldt in northern coast of California, and I didn't want to go to school on the coast, so I moved to Oregon and was going to get into landscape architecture there. I realized that the forestry was not, I was going to be working for people who were actually doing a lot of cutting of timber,
mm-hmm.
And I wanted to protect the forest. I wanted to protect the natural values. At that point, I had become pretty much indoctrinated into an environmental way of living.
Okay.
And so I really didn't want to be exploiting the forest. I wanted to be protecting it. And the only jobs were in exploiting it.
Right.
So I moved to Eugene and realized that I was thinking, okay, landscape architect was what they had here that was closest aligned to that. And I ran out of the GI Bill.
Okay.
And ended up living on a farm outside of Eugene for about 25 years. And I did a couple more years of schooling in the tractor mechanics class.
Mm-hmm.
And that helped me get through. I was able to pick up jobs. They were part-time and periodic and occasional. but I gradually was thinking in terms of very low impact on the planet by not earning very much money, which didn't make me very much of a likely person to work for a job that full-time. And I began working for nonprofits in recycling. And I was also on this place that I lived. I was a caretaker. That's where I helped the people build their country home. And I took care of farm animals and did a lot of sort of hobby farm type activities. We had a tractor and a baler, and we would bale hay for sheep, things of that nature. And until these folks passed on, they actually ended up, they gave the property to one of their grandkids, and I needed to move out from there, and I went back to school at the University of Oregon in environmental studies, because I didn't have a degree yet. And so I finally got my degree in 1996 or 97.
All right.
And right now I'm working as a environmental stewardship technician, basically, in a park where I'm restoring natural habitat where once there was a farm.
Okay. All right. And so you've been doing this since 96?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, I guess this pretty much takes us up to the present, of course. So, but before fully wrapping things up, what I like to do is just ask you a few broad questions about the war and your opinion. And I know we've talked about some of the stuff a good bit, but just to get your opinion on some of the things, and you can say as much or as little as you'd like for this.
Okay.
All right. Looking back on the Vietnam War and the entire in the Vietnam era, with your experiences since then, looking back on it from your perspective today, how do you feel about American involvement in Vietnam?
I think that I think the Americans, to the degree that we were a homogeneous culture, homogeneous culture. We're very ill-informed to think that they could do what they set out to do in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they understood the resistance of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And that the people had, you know, the value of having that the Vietnamese had been in conflict with a lot of different superpowers, quote unquote, that wanted to exploit that area of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
As far as how I was associated with that, I feel that as people come up, as individuals come up through our culture, we're not offered, or we don't have time to understand or to integrate the information that is available to us, and so we take a lot of people's word for it.
Mm-hmm.
And take it on faith and say, okay, we're going to do what our powerful people say we should do.
Mm-hmm.
And to the extent that that isn't necessarily the right thing to do, it would be great if we had some way to work that out. I don't know what to do with that. I'm struggling with it even now because obviously we've not done very well by ourselves because of where we're at right now.
Right. Okay. What do you feel about U.S. policy towards Vietnam and Southeast Asia today in this developing relationship that we have with them?
I think it has a lot of potential in that obviously there are going to be interactions with between cultures, between political entities, between people who are sort of have a different idea of how they want to operate on the planet. And being able to negotiate those in such a way that we don't get exploited and we are not overwhelmed by either their aggression or their and that we don't overwhelm them.
Mm-hmm.
We need to be involved, or we need to be thinking about them, and we need to actually try to reach some sort of, I don't think we're ever going to eliminate tension, but I think we need to get to a point where we can talk to them in a way that's respectful and gains their respect so that we don't feel threatened, or we aren't unduly threatened by what's happening there in their country or in our country. I think there's a lot going on down there, and there's in Southeast Asia, and the fact that it's so much affected by what's going on in China and India.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that there's anything that we have to offer that other than just a voice that says it would be worthwhile not to create the strife that we had in the Vietnam War. It would be nice to try to maintain it in something that's relatively peaceful rather than have it be based on reaction and armed conflict.
Right. Okay. You mentioned quite a bit earlier about how you, anytime there's anything about Guam in the news, you like to keep up with it. Have you ever been back to Guam or Okinawa or thought about doing so?
Well, I've certainly thought about it. I'm not sure. I've seen enough or recognized enough that you never can go back and see the same thing that you had before.
Right.
I've gone places where I've recognized that you've got to go through so many things, so many layers of I'm having a real tough time going anywhere else where it's not just a big commercial. Getting through the commercial aspect of it is really tough, to where I really get a chance to experience the natural world or the culture itself. It's very difficult to do that in this planet with so many people trying to do it. So I'm not thinking about it at all as an option.
Okay.
At this point.
All right. Just a couple more questions. How would you say, or has it, or how would you say your military experience and your time in the Air Force affected you, or did it have an impact on your life?
Oh, I think it very much did.
Okay.
I have to say that, you know, one of the things that people talk about, kids, especially young men, leaving home and going into the military to come out a man, you know, to get that experience, to figure out what you are, where you are, out of the influence of your family. It very much was instrumental in that, and so it's a big part of my identity. I don't claim it that much, and haven't until recently, when I felt that it was something where I wouldn't, where I could present it in such a way that people could feel free about saying, you know, whatever they thought about it. But for the most part, I felt that people are very respectful of the fact that I did it. And I think they also can do that because they understand that the kids at that age are not particularly capable of understanding what they're getting into. So, and one thing that I didn't talk about, and we didn't talk about, is that I was also part of an Agent Orange study.
Oh, okay.
And to the extent that I went through that, that was a fairly intense thing that went on for 20 years. Even though I was a control subject, because I was not actually sprayed, I worked on similar aircraft, and they needed people in their control study. So,
right.
I felt that during that program, and the fact that I'm also using VA hospital services, and though I'm not disabled, I do get from my experience, my Vietnam era experience, a good break on medical stuff that I might need. And so I've begun that and availed myself of that for the last, 10 years. But I get that you know, not everybody's well taken care of by the military, but it's an amazing system that cares for that many people to that degree, I think it was a positive experience generally.
Okay.
I certainly can't say anything else because I didn't experience other stuff, you know, while I was doing it. So it had a big effect on me, and I'm sure that it, in recognition of the fact that if you have an organization of people that have a mission, that it's very valuable, especially in defense of either ideals or a country, or you really do, it does benefit from having something organized instead of having something chaotic as an organization to do that kind of stuff, if it's necessary.
Okay.
The difficulty, though, is that it has a momentum of its own, and like it did in Vietnam, it kind of got stuck in something that it really probably didn't need to do.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else you'd like to say before we wrap this up? Anything else we need to cover?
I don't think so. I can't think of anything. I think I've spoke about a lot more things than I thought I would be.
Okay.
When I started.
All right. Well, if you don't mind, I'll go ahead and stop the recording and talk to you for a few more minutes afterwards. That's all right.
Okay.